Hi there, Marco Werman here. Right now, our inboxes are full of requests for support from so many worthy causes. I get it. Include the world among the causes that deserve your support. I'm so proud of the work our team has done in the past year, especially ongoing, deeply reported projects. Take Shirin Jafari's reporting on the ground in Afghanistan, Monica Campbell's coverage from Haiti. There's The Big Fix, our series about solutions to climate change, and Jorge Valencia's coverage of the immigration crisis at the southern border of Mexico. This fall, our website got a makeover. It looks great, but more importantly, we removed all third-party data trackers that can follow us around the web. Ours is one of the very few news organizations to take this step. We're doing it because we respect your time, attention, and privacy. We just want to bring you the news. All of this is possible because listeners like you have donated to the world. If you've been thinking about donating but haven't done it yet, now is the time. We need you to step forward today. Make your gift at theworld.org/give. A gift of $130 or $11 a month will get you a personal shout-out from me on this very podcast. Every gift matters, so what are you waiting for? Theworld.org/give. That's the last thing I'm going to say before on to the show. The CDC tells us it's time to get a COVID booster. That comes with some guilt when people across the world haven't even gotten a first shot. Dr. Fauci argues both can happen.
For every dose we give to a person in the United States, we give three doses to low and middle income countries.
Also ahead, in Turkey, inflation is hiking up prices fast.
I've seen Turkish citizens posting on Twitter that, you know, they fill up their shopping basket at a store, and by the time they get to checkout, prices have moved up.
And a family in Kenya lost all their savings, then came COVID.
And as we were sitting around thinking, what on earth are we gonna do? How do we pick ourselves up again? We decided, well, maybe samosas is the way.
When life gives you lemons, make street food. All coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is very good to have you with us on this Thanksgiving Eve. After last year's first COVID Thanksgiving, there's an odd sense that the coast is now clear. And yet COVID cases in the U.S. and many parts of the world are surging. To sort through why and what we should be doing about it, we reached out this morning to the nation's top infectious disease specialist, Dr. Anthony Fauci. He told me the first principle of safe gatherings is vaccination.
There is a major, major difference in risk when you look at the unvaccinated versus the vaccinated. Now, when you say that, people immediately say, ah, yes, but now with the Delta variant, there are significant degrees of breakthroughs in individuals who are vaccinated and who yet get usually a mild infection from someone who almost certainly was not vaccinated. So you don't want people to be discouraged in not having a family gathering when people are vaccinated in an indoor setting. You don't need to wear a mask when you're in with a family setting when everyone's vaccinated. The issue that you mentioned a moment ago is worthy of comment, and that is traveling. So there will be traveling, and there should be traveling in the holiday season. But you have to be careful. For example, when you go to an airport, that's the ultimate crowded indoor congregate setting. So keep your mask on, particularly around food courts where people are taking their masks off and eating and laughing and doing the kind of joyous things you do. Keep that mask on. When you get on the plane, you have to wear the mask. So even though there's an increased risk of transmission during a traveling surge, that doesn't mean that you should not travel if you want to see family, friends, and relatives. So you don't want people to be thinking, well, I have to essentially quarantine myself for the holidays. That's not so at all. And the other point I want to make is it's very clear now that particularly for people who've been vaccinated 6 or more months ago with the mRNA and 2 months or more ago with the J&J, that the data on the importance and the extra boost of protection you get with boosters, we're encouraging anyone 18 years of age or older to go and get the boost that you are now eligible for.
Well, on that point, I mean, my situation must be recognizable for many. I was fully vaccinated back in April, more than 6 months ago. So now, would you say I'm still fully vaccinated? That's my question. And since there's suddenly a high demand for boosters, I don't have one. How safe is it to gather in a group with other people also in that bubble?
Good question, because a lot of people are asking it. Being fully vaccinated, the definition has not changed. You are fully vaccinated. You've gotten your, did you get an mRNA, Marco? Is that what you got?
I did get an mRNA, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So then you're fully vaccinated. It is no doubt that protection wanes. It wanes more likely among elderly individuals than among a 25 or 30-year-old person. And for that reason, you still have a considerable degree of protection, particularly against hospitalization and death. But if you want to get that extra boost and an optimization of your protection, even though officially you are fully vaccinated, then we encourage you strongly to get a booster shot. Because when you look at the data, if you look particularly at the Israeli data, and now more recently data from other countries, it is very clear that the level of protection, particularly against hospitalization and death with the boosters, is dramatically higher than the peak level that you get after your second dose of an mRNA. That's a little bit of a long-winded way to say, Marco, that I would recommend that you feel good about what your status is, but get it optimized and go get boosted.
Later in the show, more of my conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci about how other countries are battling the pandemic and parallels to the efforts made battling HIV/AIDS. That's still ahead this hour. As I mentioned a moment ago, tomorrow will be the second pandemic-era Thanksgiving. There's hope that things will be more enjoyable this year. Good food, of course, helps brighten any gathering. In Nairobi, the world's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi met up with one Kenyan family whose lives and fortunes have revolved around a popular street food.
Oh, the humble samosa. When you think of it, your thoughts might drift to India or the Middle East, but here in East Africa, from Kenya to Somalia to Uganda, we all like to think samosas are our thing.
Everyone thinks the samosa is theirs. And in a way, what's kind of cool about it is, like, as it travels, it's the perfect travel food, right? It's a little pocket that you can put anything into and then fry.
That's Alea Kasam, one of the founders of Wow Eats, a family-owned samosa company based here in Nairobi. I spoke with her at her office. The sound of an old fridge hums in the background. In the back kitchen, employees are hard at work, chopping ingredients, stirring, and folding samosas into delicious, delicate triangles. For Kasam, the very scent of samosas brings her back to her childhood.
Our house always smelled of fried onions because beef samosas always have the onions and, you know, the mixture being made.
She remembers making them with her sister and grandparents.
We would just be sitting there chatting and, like, folding samosas, and you would just see the piles of triangles grow and grow and grow.
Kasam tells me that making samosas has been an on and off family business for generations.
My grandparents, back when they lived in Tanzania, used to own a bakery. And my grandfather would make the bread and my grandmother would make the samosas.
They built their business one samosa at a time, but then lost everything after Tanzania nationalized its companies. So her grandparents moved to Kenya and set up shop here, only for things to fall apart again in the 90s when the bank with all of their savings collapsed.
So we lost everything. Three generations of every single coin that we had saved. And as we were sitting around 2 years ago thinking, what on earth are we going to do? How do we pick ourselves up again? We decided, well, maybe samosas is the way. And that was the beginning of Wow Eats.
That was also the beginning of the pandemic. So Kasam and her family did what a lot of businesses in Kenya did then, turned to social media to spread the word about Wow Eats. In particular, Twitter. Now, Kenyans on Twitter, or KOT, have a reputation in the region for calling out people and for criticizing and making fun of politicians. But in this case, they came out to support Kasam's business.
Honestly, the fact that we even exist is because Kenyans on Twitter said, we want to give you a chance. It was really every box of samosas that was ordered that made us possible.
Now, nearly 2 years later, Wow Eats has become a hit. It even got a shout out from Kenya's president last year. And here's where I have to admit I am an avid consumer, because they're constantly experimenting with different creative flavors, like Nyam Chom, which stands for Nyama Choma, a popular grilled meat in Kenya, and even sweet flavors like chocolate and date and lately apple pie. You can guess who's buying those.
A lot of our American clients want apple pie samosas for Thanksgiving on Thursday, so they're super excited about that kind of nostalgia home taste.
For anybody wondering, these samosas do actually taste like apple pie. Qasem tells me that when it comes to making samosas, the options are limitless. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
In Turkey, it may look like Black Friday, with shoppers flocking to quickly snatch up smartphones, electronics, and whatever else they can get their hands on. But it's not for the deals, it's because of inflation, which is nearing 20% in Turkey, meaning that the value of the Turkish lira is plummeting. So Turks are now trying to buy as prices keep soaring. The problems are being driven in large part by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's rejection of basic economic principles. To help make sense of this, we turn to Suner Çaptay. He's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where he directs the Turkish Research Program. Suner, the headline today is that the Turkish lira is crashing to historic lows. For those of us who don't follow international finance and don't really get economics, explain what this actually means.
Indeed. I've seen Turkish citizens posting on Twitter that they fill up their shopping basket at a store, and by the time they get to checkout, prices have moved up. For 15 years, almost under Erdogan, until recently, Turkey's citizens did not know what an economic crisis or recession was. And now they're getting a very bitter taste of it. So I think this is really hurting his popularity at a level that we have not witnessed before.
So we here in the States tend to focus on the currencies of the EU, the UK, Japan. What does it matter to Americans what the value of the Turkish lira is?
So Turkey is a mid-sized economy. It's, of course, part of the global economic system. And if Turkey crashed, it would have systemic repercussions across other global economies. For instance, Spain, larger than Turkey, a significant European economy, owes a lot of Turkey's private debt, Spanish banks' debt. So if Turkey's economy went under, Spain would go under. And I think this could definitely resonate across European economies, and then, of course, hit the U.S. economy after that.
So many bankers, investors, and analysts are openly describing Turkey's monetary policy as insane and irrational. I mean, those are quotes from the former head of the Turkish Central Bank. What are the Turkish government, in particular Turkey's president, Erdogan, doing exactly?
So I think part of it is indeed irrational, in quotes, perhaps. I have followed Turkish President Erdogan's career for about 2 decades, and I've tracked Erdogan's political upbringing and antecedents. And, you know, he entered politics in Turkey and broke his teeth in politics in 1970s and 80s in a political Islam. And political Islam abhors interests because this is a sin in Islam. And so Erdogan has that. And I think he actually relishes in the fact that he's fighting interest rates. Of course, not realizing that interest rates is a cause of high inflation and not the other way around. Economics 101, I think Erdogan's view of that is blinded by his ideological convictions. But we also know that Erdogan is a very rational political person. So I think there's also another explanation, which is that Turkey's economy went into recession under Erdogan for the first time in 2018. So he's invested through companies that support him in a massive construction spree across the country, with tens of, if not hundreds of thousands of new homes being built. And the idea was that this would jumpstart the economy. Now, the problem is, with interest rates being high, citizens will not buy mortgages to purchase these homes. So Turkey now has a glut of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of homes waiting to be purchased by pro-Erdogan businesses. And I think that's why he's also trying to keep interest rates low.
So as for the impact of all this on citizens in Turkey, I mean, 20% inflation I know is high. Help us understand what that means by way of its effect on the everyday life of Turkish people right now.
So a little bit of context, Turkey actually suffered through really high inflation in the last few decades of the 20th century. I was born and raised in Turkey. I witnessed triple-digit inflation. So Turkey went through a really harsh era. And part of Erdogan's success when his party won elections in 2002 is that he lowered inflation down to single digits. And not only that, he delivered growth and he built a base that loves him. So Turkey's citizens lived in no inflation, no crisis, no recession economy for almost 2 decades. And now they're getting a really bitter taste of what Turkey used to be in the 1990s. High inflation, erratic economic management, bad policies, all of which I think is really hurting Erdogan's base. Erdogan is lucky that there are no elections for parliament or presidency in Turkey until 2023. But he has a challenge. He has to deliver phenomenal growth, exceeding 10%, double digits. If that happens, he has a chance to rebuild his base. Otherwise, I think Erdogan is a sultan in the autumn of his political career.
Sunir Choptai is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, speaking with us about Turkey's economic crisis. Thank you very much, Sunir. Really appreciate your time.
Always a great pleasure. Thank you.
How do you draw the things you can't see? Just ahead, we open a new book of maps called Atlas of the Invisible. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Maps can tell you a lot. At a basic level, they're data visualizations of latitude, longitude, and elevation. But maps can be so much more. They can show cyberspace, migration routes, environmental change. That is just the tip of the iceberg of the contents of a new book, Atlas of the Invisible. I'm here with co-author James Cheshire, who joins me from London. What do you mean, James, when you say yours is an atlas of the invisible? What is not in a traditional atlas that is in your atlas?
In a traditional atlas, you may find roads, rivers, mountains. What we want to do is use the brilliant technology of maps to reveal things that are harder to see. So things that may change over time, or things that are genuinely invisible, like gases in the atmosphere. What we're trying to do is take the complexity of our planet and distill it down into interesting and exciting maps that we can only produce today thanks to the billions of data points we now have that we collect about ourselves and our planet.
So making that invisible complexity visible. In one map, you show the places the U.S. bombed in Vietnam and Cambodia during the Vietnam War. Many of the places on your map you show still have unexploded bombs more than 50 years later. What do you hope people take away, for example, from a map like that?
The data are digitized paper maps that were created at the time when the U.S. was engaged in the Vietnam War. And by taking the declassified locations of where the bombs fell, they can be used by people trying to source the locations of bombs that are still injuring and worse people in Cambodia. But also, I think that there's a broader takeaway, which is how data can reveal things in the past that have been kind of deliberately hidden from us. And of course, the people in Cambodia knew full well that the US had a bombing campaign because it was killing and injuring them. But for the rest of the world, you know, it was kind of a state secret. And so being able to actually see that history playing out through the bombs that fell, it was kind of a big reminder that, you know, although we're showing points on a page, you know, there are people and lives that are impacted, you know, by every one of those bombs that fell.
Let me go through some of my favorite maps in this book, James. In one section, you show maps of light levels across Europe and Asia, and then you zoom into a light map of Syria. Why choose Syria, and what does that map show?
The brilliant thing about the light levels is it's kind of an image from space that we can compare over two different time periods, and you can see between 2012 and 2016, there's parts of the Earth that have got brighter, but also parts of the Earth that have got darker. The Syria example is such a stark contrast between the light and the dark. So the dark is the interior of Syria itself, where the civil war there has decimated its cities and its urban settlements. And so the lights have went out in large parts of that country. And then you have a halo of brightness around the edge of Syria into Lebanon to the west and Turkey to the north, where the people that fled into kind of refugee camps and other settlements have moved. It gives us a real kind of sense of perspective, being able to kind of look at this from space and to see how something as simple as how bright the lights are on the Earth's surface, again, can reveal some pretty profound impacts on people's lives.
I'm speaking with James Cheshire, co-author of a new book, Atlas of the Invisible. Another striking map in your atlas, the movement of Rohingya refugees from Myanmar. There's a drone photo of a Rohingya refugee camp in Bangladesh. I mean, I've heard a lot about the refugees, but these visuals just put the story in a completely different context. Was that partly the goal of the book, to make people reflect differently about what they might have seen in the news?
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about maps is that they can take you to parts of the globe that you might otherwise have never visit or seem distant to you. the fact that one of the camps in Cox's Bazar, 700,000 people moved into that camp in 3 months. The image itself of just one part of the camp taken by drone is powerful enough, and you can see people's lives. There's even things like burial grounds. There's small squares, you know, life that is this city effectively that's grown up in such a very small period. And an image alone can be incredibly powerful, and combining it with understanding the context and the flows of where people have come from in Myanmar and the journeys they've gone. Yeah, again, to me, this is a brilliant case of how we can, you know, share really powerful stories through maps data.
So you've really taken the map template far from the origins of maps as charts that show places. I mean, atlases have long contained maps that show population, minerals and other resources, rainfall. When did geographers realize that maps could illustrate other data sets?
It was actually something that von Humboldt realized. Von Humboldt was this kind of pioneering scientist who understood that the world was this giant system. He got this straight away, and he worked with a geographer called Berghaus. They created this massive atlas called the Physikalische Atlas, which was all about planet Earth and things on the Earth that weren't places. It was environmental factors, where populations were and all that kind of thing. And so we went through a phase up until sort of the 1900s where there were whole atlases of data visualizations, as we think of them today. It's only been in relatively recent years that stuff's been rediscovered, because now we've got the software where we can actually create visualizations that are just as beautiful as the kind of handcrafted work of those pioneers, that actually combines that visual element with, you know, the brilliance of the new data sets we have about us.
James, one map really blew my mind. It shows the thousands of miles of fiber optic cables under the sea. The map shows where they are, how they connect different parts of the world. I mean, that map is literally about connectivity, but how did making these maps for you change the way you think about connectivity generally in our world?
I think it's just such a visual demonstration of how information now flows. Quite precarious, really. There aren't that many cables. The other really fascinating thing about this map is how it's not just states or governments that are interested in creating this infrastructure. Companies are looking to do it too. So some of the biggest layers of these new cables are Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Amazon, because they see the value of controlling the kind of the flows of information that we're so dependent on.
What do you hope your readers take away after poring over these maps?
We want people to feel empowered by data. We can see the data, we can see the problems, and then we can translate that into action. The final map in the book is of a massive iceberg kind of breaking off the Antarctic Peninsula and spiraling towards South Georgia. And that just felt to me like a perfect metaphor for some of the challenges we face. And we can either kind of sit back and spectate that kind of thing happening and just view these maps as kind of static images of a changing world, or we can actually use them as inspiration for action. And so we can take our data to policymakers, to corporations, to even friends and family we might want to discuss these issues with, and actually show them what's happening, and then try and encourage people to act, because that's really where the power of these maps come from. It's what they inspire people to do.
James Cheshire is co-author, along with Oliver Uberti, of the new book, Atlas of the Invisible. He's in London. James, really fascinating. Thank you for explaining what you've done.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The World. Tomorrow is a day to give thanks, but sometimes a simple thank you is not always so simple. In some parts of the world, for example, saying thanks to your spouse, not such a good move.
That would almost seem overly formal. And you don't do that unless you're angry with them.
Plus, how India discovered the turkey dinner. That's all still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Let's return to my conversation today with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the chief medical advisor to President Biden. We discuss the strategies other countries are taking to battle COVID, including restricting the movement of their citizens. China and Hong Kong remained very closed off, for example, with strict quarantine protocols for entry. Austria is under a nationwide lockdown. The U.S. is not taking those steps, although some of our numbers are just as distressing. Dr. Fauci says in the U.S., those types of strategies might backfire.
Even though we know masks prevent infection and save lives, even though we know vaccines unequivocally save lives, we have a culture of divisiveness in our country where you have actually governors pushing back against requirements for masks and pushing back against requirements for vaccination. So the kind of culture, the sociology that we have in our country, I don't think it would work at all. It might be counterproductive to do some of the very, very stringent things being done in China and in Austria and in other countries.
I mean, if you take a country like Spain, lots of people wear masks. There's a very high vaccination rate. What do you think is the difference in culture between, say, Spain and the U.S.?
It's called political divisiveness. I'm not a politician, Marco. I don't want to get involved in anything that's political. But all you have to do is look at what's going on in this country, and you see people are making statements that are antithetical to public health, and they're doing it purely for political reasons. There's no running away from that. You have to be asleep not to figure that out. And that is so unacceptable when we know that the common enemy is the virus, not each other. And you have people making statements like public health officials, like myself being the prototype because I'm very visible, but I'm not the only one, that when public health officials push for things that are clearly proven to prevent infection and hospitalization and death, and they get threatened. I mean, their lives get threatened, their families get harassed. That happens to me every day.
I was going to say, this is your experience.
I mean, to me, it's beyond my experience. I mean, what kind of society do we live in when the person who's done nothing at all but push things to save people's lives and to keep them healthy is get so many threats against my life and the harassment of my wife and my children that I have to have federal agents protecting me? I mean, there's something really crazy about that. What has happened to us that when we're trying to save lives, people are being harassed for trying to save people's lives?
There's another political component that I wanted to ask you about, Dr. Fauci. In the 1980s, when you were guiding the country through the HIV/AIDS crisis, groups protested outside your office demanding more resources for research and treatment. Here we are decades later. Some of those very same people are protesting at the offices of Pfizer and Moderna, even at the homes of White House officials, calling out the lack of access and profiteering. What occurs to you about these parallel moments?
So let's go back to my extraordinarily positive experience with the AIDS activists in the 80s. You see the signs of you're killing us, you know, you're not allowing us to be part of the process. Those were noble people who were speaking the truth, who wanted to get the message to the government that they really do need to make the people who are involved, those who are afflicted with HIV/AIDS and those who are at risk, to get them to be part of the process of determining some of the policies. And they were absolutely correct. So even though they had a lot of iconoclastic and theatrical signs and activities, they were noble people. People who are pushing back against me as a public health person are ignoble. They are living on lies about what's good or what's not good. I'm not talking about the activists who are saying we want to get more availability. I'm talking about the people who inappropriately compare the AIDS activist who had the truth guiding them about what needs to be done. And what they were doing, even though they were iconoclastic, was noble. The same activists who are now making a very good point. And what they're saying is, and I agree with them completely, is that we actually need to make sure we understand that we have, and I believe this completely based on my experience with the development of the PEPFAR program with President George W. Bush.
taking on HIV and AIDS in Africa.
Yeah, taking on HIV in Africa, that we have a moral responsibility that at the same time that we provide vaccines and interventions for ourselves and do boosters, that we also make it available to low and middle income countries. And the United States, President Biden is pushing this to already give or pledge 1.1 billion doses to the developing world, to give over 200 to 300 million doses already to over 100 countries, and to work together with the activists to try and get the pharmaceutical companies to expand their capacity so that we can give doses of vaccine to the low and middle income countries.
But if you look at the map of who is getting vaccinated, it's in the wealthy countries.
Right. The other countries have got to do what the United States is doing. Some factoids for everyone. For every dose we give to a person in the United States, we give three doses to low and middle income countries. Fact number two, we are giving more doses and doing more for lower and middle income countries than all the rest of the countries in the world combined. Those are facts.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is the chief medical advisor to President Biden. Dr. Fauci, from all of us on the show, a peaceful Thanksgiving to you and all of yours.
Thank you very much, Marco. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
A quick note from Sweden. Today, Stockholm announced the country's first female prime minister. Hours later, she resigned. Magdalena Andersson quit after her budget failed to pass. Parliament had voted for a budget drawn up by the opposition to Andersson, which includes the anti-immigrant far right. But don't assume that's the end of Andersson's time in charge. The complexities of Swedish politics means she'll probably be voted in again, but possibly again in the same spot. Note to the Prime Minister's office, don't change the decor just yet. The headline from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation is tantalizing, to say the least. Is this the world's biggest sex event? The ABC is referring to the annual coral spawn on the Great Barrier Reef. It is a mating event in which trillions of eggs and sperm are released into the ocean overnight during a full moon. In daylight, this spawn resulted in a blast of fresh color, which excited scientists and people concerned about climate change. It was thought that the coral was permanently damaged. So will this year's coral spawn help revitalize the world's largest reef? Ann Cohen is a scientist who specializes in the impact of climate change on coral at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. And the photos show bright and colorful organisms. What causes that?
Corals are colorful for two reasons. One, they actually have pigment, and those pigments can be purple or pink or green or brown. But then there's also a microscopic algae that lives inside the cells of the coral polyp. And they are photosynthesizing and producing photosynthate, which actually feeds the corals. They also give corals their color.
Since 1998, the Great Barrier Reef has been progressively damaged by five major bleaching events. Remind us what bleaching is and how it happens.
All corals that build coral reefs, they live in a symbiosis, an intricate symbiosis with plant cells. So the coral provides a home for these tiny little algae, and the algae are photosynthesizing using nutrients from the water and sunlight. And they give that photosynthesis, that's a high energy product, to the coral, like an energy bar. When the water gets too hot, that cozy symbiosis, the algae actually start producing toxins. And the coral has to make a decision. Am I going to hang on to my algae so I can get food, but I'm also going to be poisoned? Or should I kick them out and risk starvation? Mm. The majority of the time, the coral will release the algae, will spit them out. The reason that that process, when the coral spits out the algae, is called bleaching is because the coral will lose its color and the corals look really white.
Gotcha. So the coral spawning, it happens every year. Why are scientists so excited about this particular annual coral spawning on the Great Barrier Reef?
The Great Barrier Reef has really been suffering from these heat waves, and a lot of the corals have been killed. The way that the corals come back from those kind of events is that the remaining corals, they will produce new babies, and those babies get disseminated on the ocean currents and settle onto the reef. That's what the expectation is, or the hope is, that this massive spawning event that's going on is going to help recover the Great Barrier Reef.
Do you think what scientists are seeing in this year's coral spawn indicates that the coral in the Great Barrier Reef is regenerating after bleaching, and could that be sustainable?
I think that's yet to be seen. The Great Barrier Reef lost a lot of corals over these successive heat waves. Some areas up to 83% of corals, or 85%, were killed. This is millions and millions of corals killed within a few weeks by a giant heat wave. So you've got much fewer corals left to actually reproduce.
When you think of your own time studying the Great Barrier Reef and seeing it up close, how do you feel about what seems to be a pretty good sign for the reef's health?
It's wonderful. Almost like nature's back. I was first on the Great Barrier Reef before the 1998 heat wave, and it was absolutely incredible. I've never seen anything like it. I went on a night dive, and it was just carpets and carpets and carpets of corals, all different shapes and sizes. I went back a few years later, and it was absolutely devastating. It just wasn't there anymore. So we're hoping now that the corals have done their bit, that there'll be enough time before the next heat wave hits for these babies to recruit to the reef substrate and to start to grow and rebuild the Great Barrier Reef.
Anne Cohen is a scientist who specializes in the impact of climate change on coral. She's at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. Professor Cohen, thank you very much, and cheers to the Great Barrier Reef.
Thanks so much, Marco. Yes, let's keep our fingers crossed there.
Here's another sex event in nature story for you. This one on Christmas Island. It sits in the Indian Ocean about 1,000 miles off the western coast of Australia, the opposite side of that continent from the Great Barrier Reef. Christmas Island has fewer than 2,000 permanent residents, human residents, that is. There are, however, some 50 million red crabs on the island. These things are the size of a man's size 12 shoe, and yesterday they were on the move. Sound effects ideal for a horror film. This is video from Parks Australia showing a road covered with an undulating crimson carpet of scuttering land crabs.
They are, literally everywhere. I get them in my house, so I'm up on the second story of a three-story building, and they'll pretty commonly climb up into my house. They sometimes fall off the roof.
In good times. Tanya Detto lives on the island and works at Christmas Island National Park. She says park staff were well prepared for crab traffic jams.
The rangers here spend a month or two before the wet season starts clearing out crab crossings, so the underpasses that the crabs go through, and also putting up some temporary crab fences along the road.
Crab fences, crab crossings, crab underpasses, that is a lot of crab infrastructure, all in the name of helping Christmas Island's red crabs migrate out of the forest and down to the beach. About 2 weeks from now, the females will lay their eggs in the water. By the way, the males take off right after mating. Each mother is left behind with about 100,000 eggs. The waves turn black, filled with a microscopic spawn. Then about a month later, tiny baby crabs scurry out of the water.
In the big returns, we actually have like leaf blowers, and we'll use those to blow the babies off the road so that we can get the cars through.
Pretty harsh on the young'uns, but Detto says residents have learned to tread lightly this time of year.
There's a special little crab dance that you do where you kind of stand on one foot and wave your other foot around so that the crabs clear a little patch so you can step down.
Kind of gives new meaning to doing the crab walk. That was Tanya Detto, program coordinator for Christmas Island National Park. She spoke with our colleagues at CBC Radio's As It Happens. You would have a hard time finding turkeys on dining tables in India, but turkey is steadily gaining popularity there. Reporter Sandeep Roy in Kolkata says the trend brings in local flavors, but it got a jumpstart thanks to nostalgic images of American and English meals.
As winter approaches, poultry sellers appear on the streets of Kolkata with some unusual black and white birds. Australian chickens, I heard one bystander say confidently once. Actually, turkeys. This time of the year, they show up on winter special menus in hotels and restaurants in Kolkata. And little turkey farms have sprung up around the city. Rezaul Kalam has one about 35 miles from Kolkata. He says he thought of keeping chickens, but turkeys are hardier and make for good backyard birds. He also likes the way they dance.
They're dancing like a peacock.
Kalam once lived in Brooklyn, but says he only tried chicken breast from delis.
And my wife also doesn't know how to cook the turkey.
He says she cooks it just like a chicken curry. There are other problems, as I discovered when I tried to buy a whole turkey. My turkey was handed to me alive. I needed to get it butchered. Even after that, Most ovens here are not big enough for a full bird. Later, I discovered Tona Farms, an organic farm an hour outside Kolkata, sells not just whole turkeys, dressed and dead, thankfully, unlike mine, but also turkey parts, as they call them, curry cut. Shoma Roy runs Tona's store. She's come up with a line of ready-to-eat meals with their more exotic meats that satisfy spicy Indian palates.
Cheese turkey, honey rabbit, and ajwanda.
The cheese turkey is cooked with cashew nut paste and some grated cheese. The cheese at the end just melts into the turkey, she says, while giving me the recipe in Bengali.
এবং লাস্টলি হবে কি ওই চিজে আর টার্কিটাতে ওই গরমেই মোটামুটি মিশে যায়.
Now the state government is also selling turkeys, which its brochures call unconventional meats. Their cooking hints suggest marinate with brine solution and turmeric powder, sauce, vinegar, black pepper, chili paste, and a little oil. Turkeys in India mostly belong to a few breeds, such as Beltsville, Bronze, White Holland. Tona Farm started with just a handful of turkeys in
2003.
Roy says they thought of emus as well, but there was just not enough room, and the meat was too tough. Now they have a hard time keeping up with turkey demand from consulates and hotels and ordinary people too. Though it's still more for curry cut than whole turkeys. But if you want a whole one, she has some recipe suggestions for that too.
যেমন আমি একটু রসুন মাখন আর তন্দুরি মশলা ইয়ে আপনার দই এগুলো দিয়ে আর নামাবার সময়
garlic, butter, yogurt and some tandoori masala and a little cheese. It may have started off as a turkey and trimmings nostalgia inspired by the West, but the turkey in India is getting an Indian reincarnation. For the world, I'm Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
Don't be rude, say thank you. As kids here in the US, we're taught to say thank you whenever possible. But a thank you, as we understand it here, is not always the same in other languages and cultures. To explain, we're joined now by Elaine Xie. She's a professor at the University of Oklahoma, where she studies language and culture. So let's just establish the baseline, Elaine. What is the role of a thank you here in the U.S.? I mean, I think we all know the answer, but how is the term thank you used here?
Thank you is used in almost everyday life. We say it all the time to everybody we see. We use it so often that we are not very reflective. It's almost like we say it just to be polite.
And given that kind of automatic, impulsive way we use thank you, I mean, does it lose its meaning? Does it lose its power over time?
I think so. The ways in English, how we use thank you is very transactional. A common way to say thank you or to show gratitude is like, I owe you a ton of debt. Like, I owe you lots. I don't know how to repay you. So These are very transactional understanding of thank yous that not all cultures use thank you that way. And some cultures, they don't even say thank you easily because thank you is reserved for some of the most heartfelt moments to signify the importance of their gratitude.
Yeah, give us a few examples of that, like expressions of gratitude and how they differ in other languages and cultures.
So, for example, in India, thank you is not something that you say in a regular basis. But even though you don't say thank you, there's an inherent sense that gratitude is felt. And oftentimes it's expressed through nonverbal behaviors rather than the words thank you. In Chinese, there's a very famous article that's called Xie Tian. Xie means thank you. Tian is sky. There are so many things and so many people we are thankful for, we're grateful to, that let's just say Xie Tian, thank the sky. And when you say it that way, when you start to think about gratitude is toward everything and all beings under sky, that moves expression of gratitude away from a transactional understanding of gratefulness, but into sort of a all-encompassing understanding of kindness toward the world and how you're recipient all the good things, goodwills in the world.
Elaine, as you said, in Hindi, there's kind of an unspoken or an assumed gratitude. So if a kid asks a parent in India for a glass of water, Would thank you be inappropriate?
Yes, it would be perceived to be inappropriate, and it would be perceived almost kind of intentionally over-distancing the relationship. So in some ways, we can think of in our everyday life, husband and wife may talk in a certain way. But if you always say, please thank you whenever you ask your husband or wife to do something for you, that would almost seem overly formal. And you don't do that unless you're angry with them. And so to me, learning about what other cultures do is not about we need to adopt other cultures' practice or language, but more as a reflective point to see how other cultures' way of thinking, saying, and doing things provide us the opportunity to reflect on our practice.
That's really interesting. I mean, I know you speak, obviously, English and Mandarin and Taiwanese. How do you approach your language of gratitude? Are you now more aware about how and when to say thank you?
Yes, definitely. Actually, one concept came to me was about the Taiwanese use of gamshim. Gamshim in literal meaning is feel hard. I ended up calling my mom about, you know, I know gamshim is the way we express gratitude, but what is it? And my mom was like, you know, gamshim is not really a way of saying thank you because you're just showing the community how much you appreciate the good deed. These ways of expressing gratitude, like other language, like Taiwanese or Chinese expression of gratitude, they move away from the transactional understanding of gratitude and open up a world that we normally wouldn't have considered.
Elaine Chia is a professor at the University of Oklahoma, speaking with us about the languages of gratitude. Elaine, I asked questions, you gave answers. One could see it as a transaction still. I really sincerely thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Get caught up every weekday and follow the same news headlines our editors here at The World are following. We curate three top stories plus some favorite features and send it all straight to your inbox in our newsletter, Top of the World. Subscribe at theworld.org. And while you're there, catch up on stories you might have missed on the show, like Shirin Jafari's report on how people in Beirut are managing without electricity, or Lucia Benavides' story about how the Beatles had a political impact on Argentina. That's all at theworld.org. Grammy nominations came out this week, and given the Americanness of tomorrow's holiday and gatherings, we thought we'd spin a little something from the U.S. in the Best Regional Roots Album category. Artists who perform music that is deeply connected to place. Think Cajun Zydeco or Hawaiian slack key guitar. Or these guys, Chawa from New Orleans, a place that for centuries has channeled sounds from all over, the Bayou, the Caribbean, Africa, Spain, and France. This is the title track from Chawa's Grammy-nominated album, My People.
Rich people still living high and dry. Poor people, they watching the waters rise. Oh, yeah. Most people don't even bat at night. My people.
Own Chawa with the title track from their Grammy-nominated recording, My People. To all of you and your people from all of us, wishing you good health, happiness, and fortune on this Thanksgiving 2021. A special edition of the show on tap for you tomorrow. Get out your napkins because it's all food stories from around the globe. The World broadcasts from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're online all the time at theworld.org. Relax, stay safe, and be strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
We've been living high before, high before.
reminder to our listeners, the world is free for everyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. We report stories from around the globe with nuance, context, and by listening to voices of people most affected by the news. Do your part today to help us keep access to the world free. Make your gift at theworld.org/give. Thank you for listening, and be well.